Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is The Jackpod, where On Point news analyst Jack Beattie helps us connect history, literature, and politics in a way that brings his unique clarity to the world we live in now. Hi there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
We are at episode 31. What's today's headline?
The company they keep.
Aha. Okay. So tell me more.
Well, let me begin this way. Here's something you don't know about me, Meghna. I owe 4 of my surviving 8 teeth to the Teamsters Union. It's true. Whose dental benefits really saved my rotting teeth years ago. So when I bite into a steak, I silently say, "The union forever." And that reinforces something in my biography. My father, among other men, helped to found a union, the Custodians Union, in the Boston Public Schools. And they changed it. One of the first things they did was change the name from janitors to custodians. And I asked him, I was a kid, why? And he said, dignity. I didn't know what he meant. I do now. So unions are in my blood and in my teeth. And therefore, it was with anguish and anger that I read something in an outstanding article in the New Republic by Tim Noah about President Obama. It turned out in his first year in office, he had a chance to push a bill the labor unions wanted that would make it much easier for unions to organize. And he had voted for it as a senator, but he was persuaded not to do that by not one, not two, but 3 Chicago billionaires. Mm. They talked him out of this measure. And 2 authors say, quote, that forfeited any chance to alter the Democrats' narrow governing coalition and to create a genuine counterweight to the influence of business and Wall Street. The company he kept, these billionaires, persuaded him not to help working people. And that was an emblematic moment in the modern history of the Democratic Party. Just staying with the billionaires. According to one study, over the decade, basically the last 10 years, 12 mega donors, 6 Republicans, 6 Democrats, have made a combined $3.4 billion in donations.
Oh, my gosh.
In the 2022 congressional campaign, American billionaires spent $880 million. And they were led in that spending by George Soros, spending for the Democrats $128 million. Mm-hmm. Also figuring in the Democrats' billionaire backer category was the infamous Sam Bankman-Fried.
Oh, geez.
Who coughed in, yeah, the crypto crook, who coughed in $40 million to the Democrats. And it turns out not only did the Democrats have friends, the company, not only was the company they were keeping billionaires, but the Democrats in 2020 actually got more money in dark money contributions than the Republicans. They got more than the Republicans did, $1 billion. And of course, dark money is almost certainly contributed by rich people who don't want their identities known by the public, but they want the politicians to know they're giving. So the Democrats, dark money, they have their, and according to, and at the official level, there were 42 billionaires contributing to that 2020 campaign, and 17 of them were to the Democrats. So they're very comfortable, this party, it seems, with the richest Americans. Not only that, they're also comfortable with America, increasingly with American business. Rahm Emanuel, the current ambassador to Japan and erstwhile mayor of Chicago, he says corporate America has no home in the Republican Party anymore. One recent study says, our evidence suggests a widespread view that companies are increasingly aligned with Democrats. And the question is it that Democrats are liberalizing the companies, or is it that the companies, are affecting the Democrats? But we don't know. But they have grown more liberal as the Democrats have grown more corporate. So the company, increasingly the Democrats are keeping, is American business. In fact, one scholar calls it the partisan realignment of American business to the Democratic Party. A third group of people with whom the Democrats are keeping company are college graduates. It turns out that next to race, the best predictor of voting behavior in America is education. If you've got a college degree, chances are very strong you're going to vote for the Democrats. If you don't, the chances are very strong indeed that you're going to vote for the Republicans. Biden carried college grads in 2020 by 15 points, but lost by 30-odd points white working class, that is, non-college voters. And what does it mean that the Democrats are increasingly reliant on college graduate votes? Well, for one thing, these people are doing better than working class voters. According to one study, since 1989, families headed by someone with a college degree saw 83% increase in wealth. Meanwhile, there were little or no increase for families headed by non-college people. So the Democrats used to do very well among non-college, and they got creamed among college grads. JFK lost them by 2-1. Now all that is reversed. And increasingly, the company the Democrats keep is the company of more affluent college graduates. And the question that raises is this. Can a Democratic Party with increasing support from affluent voters, is it going to diminish its ability to, you know, enact the kind of redistributive policies that would check rising inequality? This phenomenon of new constituents in the Democratic Party putting a brake on efforts to help out working people and poor people, this was adumbrated in the early 1980s by a classic book from Tom Edsel called The New Politics of Inequality. And he pointed out how the Democrats elected in the Watergate years were reformers and procedural people, and they wanted, you know, new regulations and so on, and they were increasingly representing suburban districts, and they increasingly had distant from organized labor. And that really was the beginning of the turn away of the Democrats from working class voters. And maybe the same thing, a similar pattern is being repeated now with billionaires and companies and college grads, increasingly with the Democrats, while working people, not so much.
But Jack, I can think of, I just have a quick response to you for that, from that, which is two words. Joe Biden. Right? I mean, he's embraced unions more than any recent president of memory, in memory.
He sure has, and I think we may even have some sound from him speaking on a picket line in Warren, Michigan, first president ever to be on a picket line.
You saved the automobile industry back in 2008 and before. Made a lot of sacrifices, gave up a lot, and the companies were in trouble. But now they're doing incredibly well, and guess what? You should be doing incredibly well, too.
So, Jack, I guess my question to you is, if Biden, who is president now and also the head of the Democratic Party, he's so vocally pro-union, I mean, does that sort of weaken the argument that that Democrats as a whole have turned away from organized labor?
organized labor and working people generally know there's really strong and I find it shocking evidence on the other side, cited by Tim Noah in this outstanding New Republic article. An exhaustive study was done of communications that Democratic members of Congress gave to the electorate. You know, what was on their website? What did they send in messages and so on? The search words workers, wages, jobs, working families, only 6% of the congressional were appeared in only 6% of the Democrats' sample communication with the voters. And they found that fewer than 30% of Democratic candidates mentioned the need for higher paying jobs. So in the language that the members of Congress were using to connect with voters, work had gone out of the picture. Whereas Democrats were 6 times more likely to mention abortion rights than working families, jobs, wages. And of course, that may well be something that happens again this year, given the Democrats' edge on that issue. But if they're emphasizing abortion rights to the neglect of the language of the working class, they're in trouble. And in fact, Tim Noah puts it this way: it's almost as though New Deal liberalism, once the Democrats' prevailing ideology, had stopped being an ideology at all, but instead had become some ancient language like Latin or Sanskrit that Democrats no longer knew how to speak.
Okay. So, Jack, I definitely take your point because the evidence that you've provided is very, very strong. But just to note briefly, because we have been sort of eliding from organized labor and unions to working class Americans as a whole, but there's not 100% overlap there, obviously, because, I mean, union membership, even though it may be more in the news these days, is still at relative historic lows, right, Jack? So there's a difference between the two.
Oh, indeed. It's only about 8% of the private sector working workforce is represented by a union, 12% of the workforce overall, if you add in public sector workers. That's compared to 35% of the workforce when the Teamsters Union was fixing my teeth.
Okay. But your point about working class voters overall, including union members, is very well taken, Jack. I think you also have some numbers about how we can see the ongoing impact of Democrats becoming more corporatized, to put it that way, in terms of you had talked to me a while ago about slippage in numbers for President Biden.
Oh, well, yes. I mean, dramatic. Lost by 30 points among white working class voters. And he lost, and he's the only Democrat elected to lose the non-college vote aggregately, that is, white and non-white. And he lost it by 3 or 4 points, but he's the only elected Democrat who has. And the Democrats did very well among college graduates. They look forward to doing that again. But can they become a majority party on that basis? It doesn't seem so. Tim Noah cites data that for every one working class voter they lose, they have to get 3 college graduates simply because there are so many more non-college people in the population.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so by talking about all this and the company they keep or have been keeping, Jack, I guess the obvious next question is, can Democrats win back working class voters?
Well, Tim Noah has a lot of suggestions in his article about it, and I know you're going to have him on the show to talk about that. I'll just go around those and just go to one of the things he mentioned. What about if the Democrats have lost the language of the working class, what about having working class candidates who speak that lingua franca as if it's their, you know, birthright? And there's one such in the last camp in 2022. There was one such candidate, a 34-year-old woman from in Eastern Washington, Marie Glusenkamp Perez. who was an auto body shop owner, and she ran an ad that sounded like this.
My name's Marie Gluzenkamp-Perez. Life looks different down a gravel road. We get our water from a well, we get our internet from a radio tower, and we heat our home with wood. I come from a long line of loggers. I'll rebuild jobs in the woods. I will invest in technical education to help rebuild American manufacturing. I'll protect our freedoms, the Second Amendment, and our right to make our own healthcare decisions. I approve this message as I'm definitely not your typical candidate for Congress.
Honestly, Jack, I have to say, as a native of Oregon, next door to Washington in the Pacific Northwest, the sound of that chainsaw rings familiar in my ear. But she doesn't sound like a Democrat.
No, no. And she barely made it against a Trumpist Republican, I think by 1 or 2 points. And people are pointing to her. That's what we need, more people like that. And because if you look at Congress, someone has called it government by millionaires. Mm-hmm. In 2020, more than half of all members were millionaires. Nearly two-thirds of the Senate were millionaires. And the, you know, people say, well, we need representation. We need, in order to have representation from minority groups, representation from women, that it's very important to have people like America in high positions. Well, someone has calculated that if people like America were in the Senate, not 2% of the Senate, which where people had blue-collar jobs before they were elected, but 60% of the seats would be represented by working candidates.
Yeah.
Working class candidates.
If only money hadn't completely corrupted politics, right? Because in order to even launch a campaign in this day and age, you need to have some wealthy donors to get you off to a good start. And if perchance you win, right, it's just very expensive to even be a working legislator that has to, A, travel back and forth from Washington to their own district, and then, you know, housing costs in the nation's capital are prohibitively high. I mean, those are just like three examples of many that we could put together to say, really, the massive hurdle that needs to be overcome always comes back to money. And that just shutting out a lot of working class Americans who might otherwise really want to and be effective politicians. They can never even get started.
Yes. I mean, they can't get in the door. They can't raise money. This is also true of women candidates. They have a much harder time raising money. But, you know, there is an Emily's List for early money makes the yeast rise, or early, you know what that is.
Yeah.
Anyway, aiding, maybe there needs to be something like that for our working class candidates, a fund that would help them at least get over that initial barrier. The barrier on housing is a difficult one indeed. Be interesting to find out how this new congresswoman from Washington, how is she managing it? She's got a small family, lives in on the West Coast. How is she doing it? Mm-hmm. Maybe we should have her on the show.
Jack, you keep seeding us with future show ideas. I love it. Well, so this brings us to the question, right, that we want to ask our very loyal Jack Potters. So clearly Jack is making the case here that Democrats have lost touch with working class Americans. And you, one measure of it is what he's offered by the company they keep, by the billionaires they hobnob with, by the corporations that are major donors and influential in elite Democratic circles. So, A, do you think Democrats have lost touch with working class Americans of any political stripe? And B, what could they or should they do, the Democratic Party, to get back in touch with working class voters? And again, this isn't a small group of Americans, as Jack's pointed out, that we have working class or non-college educated voters are 60% of the United States. So what can the Democrats do? That's what we want to know for this week's Jack Pod. And you have the On Point Vox Pop app on your phone. I know, looking at you, Howard. Looking at you, Joe, out in Los Angeles. But for everyone who doesn't have the On Point Vox Pop app on your phone, just go to wherever you get your podcast, look for On Point Vox Pop, and definitely become part of our very robust and vibrant conversation that we have here every week with Jack. So, Jack, I gave a shout out to Joe in L.A., and he, by the way, regarding last week's podcast and the potential consequences about deepening isolationism in the U.S., here's what he had to say.
Mr. Beatty, you just hit it out of the park. It is probably no surprise to you that I am a glass half empty patriot. Your recollections of President Reagan's words at Normandy and the way you tied them to our present day filled that glass just a little bit more.
Joe, I see you're coming over to my side of being a glass half full American patriot. Come, it's happy and sunny and optimistic over here. But we'll hear more listener thoughts just after the break. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
Okay, Jack, we're back. And just to remind folks, last week, you were speaking with Dori Scheimer last week, who was sitting in for me. Great episode, by the way. But you talked about a speech from former President Ronald Reagan that he gave on the 40th anniversary of D-Day. And we're now almost at the 80th anniversary. And you were wondering about whether the United States might return to a period of isolationism. Okay, so we heard a little bit of what Joe from Los Angeles sent us. Here's more of what he had to say. He says, a major factor in increased U.S. isolationism is the impact of global trade.
The stake is found in the security of global trade that comes from the sole country with the naval and diplomatic power to provide it. We are already seeing an increase in ocean piracy as the U.S. withdraws closer to its home borders. Lacking for a world's policeman, the unfettered movement of goods around the world, to which we have become accustomed since 1945, can no longer be taken for granted. Even if the U.S. succeeds as an island of prosperity in this poor world, the conflict will eventually, as history has shown, end up at our front door.
What do you think, Jack?
Yeah, I think that that argument, the last one about the conflict will be at our front door, that was cited again and again in the House debate over the weekend when, hearteningly, in a strong bipartisan vote, the House voted to aid the embattled Ukrainian democracy, and led by, I should say, an extraordinary act of statesmanship by the Speaker, Mike Johnson, who got religion on this simply because he got the facts, apparently. They gave him the presidential brief, and he knew just how perilous things were in Ukraine, and that shifted him. And he risked, and we will have to find out whether it'll happen, he risked losing his speakership on that. And I don't know of a bolder or braver action from a politician in years.
Now, before we get to the next bit of listener feedback, which will come from Howard, our man in Indiana, I just want to take a second to tell Jack Potters that even though we do feature voices that regularly give us their feedback on the Jackpod, we are not a members-only club, right? I want to hear from as many people out there who listen to the Jackpod about what you think about the various topics that Jack's covered. So if you're, I don't know, in North Dakota, if you're in New Orleans, if you're in Anchorage, if you're in Miami, wherever you are, just definitely send us your thoughts, because it really makes this ongoing dynamic conversation that Jack's having with you, with the nation, much, much richer. So don't be put off by Joe being a regular and Howard Turner, our regular, who's the man with the view from Elkhart, Indiana. So here's what he had to say, Jack. He thinks you are overstating the problem.
Well, there are people both on the left and right that want us to withdraw some from the world, I don't think we will become isolationists again. A small group on the left are wanting us to stop being the world's police, but to still be engaged. The even smaller MAGA group are too confused to know what they want. While they want to align with other dictators, but their America First policy will prevent that. Plus, we also have to consider all the jobs that would be lost if we stopped arming the world. Our industrial military complex will not allow that much isolationism.
Ah, that's interesting. Jack, what do you think?
Yeah, that's Howard is always getting to the trench and stuff. according to data, defense spending contributes about 3% to the GDP. That's not nothing, but it's not it's not Apple Computer. And employment is obviously one of the big forces behind defense spending. And in, I was just looking it up in Howard's Elkhart area, he's got Kensington Aerospace Defense, which makes complex machines for the aerospace industry and defense industry. He's got Dynamic Metals, which does the same thing. So even out there in Elkhart, folks are going to work on the Pentagon's dime. And, question is, do we really need to spend more on defense than the next 9 countries combined? That is a question.
Yeah. Oh, you know my obsession with the defense budget, Jack.
Yes.
And that half of it goes to 5 contractors, essentially. Don't get me started on that. We will continue to do many shows on the defense budget. But we've got one more here, Jack. This is from Jeffrey Addison in Buffalo, New York. He says he's a loyal listener, and he wants your help in making sense of a couple of the themes that you've talked about.
I'd really like to hear you explain this delicate balance that I think that you're trying to weave. You're at one point saying, we need to stand with our allies and not be isolationists. But you're also saying that we can't fall into meddler's trap, while you're also saying, hey, we need to give money for Ukraine, but that money is also combined with money to Israel, and we need to put conditions on the money to Israel. So how do you exactly weave that thread?
Oh my gosh, Jack! Jeffrey, you are an A-plus student in the College of Jackpotting, because, wow, I think he just weaved together 4 or 5 different episodes. Amazing, Jeffrey! Okay, Jack, well, I hand it off to you. How do you weave all that together?
I abide in contradiction. That's how I do it. there is a difference between internationalism, right? Helping other nations abroad when they're in peril, and intervention. Intervention is the thing you've got to avoid. That gets you into the meddler's trap when you send forces abroad. The thing about Ukraine is they're doing the fighting for us. Our soldiers aren't at risk over there. Our arms are going over there. They're defending their freedom. But we're not intervening with our own forces. And it's the intervention with forces that creates the disasters of American foreign policy, from Vietnam to the Iraq War, Afghanistan, you name it. Where we go, blunder follows and death follows for us and for the poor, unfortunate people who are under our bombs and bullets. So I would distinguish between internationalism through alliance systems and so on from in unilateral intervention. That's the distinction I think to make.
Jack, this podcast is such a thrill. I have to say, Jeffrey, thank you so much for your absolutely brilliant question. I would have never come up with that. It was fantastic. And Jack, thank you for your answer.
I would have gone on, but I don't want to bite off more than I can chew.
With your union-funded teeth, right?
That's it.
Well, Jack, thank you as always.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is The Jackpod from On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.